time.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, and health policy, media, and popular attitudes. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being, or well-being as a species and a human community, with the well-being of our society and our Earth. And we talk about that every week on the show. It's been 9 years of different thought leaders, authors, activists, doctors, scientists, filmmakers, all sorts of people connecting the dots in our interconnected, ecological, biologically systemic world. And on today's show, we actually have a wonderful, kind of expansion of that theme. I'm delighted to bring on today Isabella Tree. She is the author of a moving, beautiful, and very eye-opening book called Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. And on today's show, she'll be sharing her experience of tending the transformation of a former conventional farm in Sussex, England, to a wild, ancient landscape and wildlife habitat. We met at a talk she gave a couple of days back, and I have to say, it was one of the most moving talks, as we've had Climate Week and Climate Month and ongoing action here in the U.S. to get a handle on the social and industrial choices that are driving our habitat over the edge and rendering so many species extinct. This is a beat that I've been focusing on for over a decade. This show has been on the air for 9 years, and this is one of the most not only hopeful, not only solution-based, but core, heartfelt, and really central visions of the human place in our natural world, of the natural world, and of what we need to connect with and understand in order to be in right relationship with it. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Isabella Tree.
Thank you very much.
It's really great having you here.
Well, it was wonderful to meet you the other night. It's fantastic. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, well, just so delighted. I have to say, during your talk, as you talked about the transformation and rewilding of the Knepp property that you and your husband oversee in England, both the stories and the photographs and the films that you showed, as well as the embedded love for all species of wildlife and of nature that came through, I was crying for most of your talk.
Well, that's a wonderful reaction to have. I can't say I was delighted you were crying, but it's a wonderful reaction. Yeah, I mean, we've been on a very long journey, I think, my husband mm-hmm. and I, from being intensive farmers to doing what we're doing. And it's wonderful to be able to tell a positive story against all this background of gloom and disaster.
Would you give our listeners, please, a little just kind of overview of the trajectory of where you've been with this property and where it is now, just so that, they can be oriented to the kind of basic narrative of what's happened here.
Yes, so my husband Charlie and I inherited a farm which is large by English standards. It's 3,500 acres in West Sussex in the southeast of England. In the 1980s, we inherited it from his grandparents, and it was a very intensive arable and dairy farm, and we assumed that we would literally be farmers for the rest of our lives. Charlie had been to agricultural college, We felt that this was what we would be going to do, you know, for the next few decades. The problem was that the farm was already losing money hand over fist. And when we took it on, we felt that, you know, it had been rather neglected. The Charlie's grandparents hadn't invested in infrastructure. They didn't know all these all-singing, all-dancing latest technologies that Charlie had come up with at college. And Charlie felt very strongly that he could turn the fortunes of the farm around. And so for 16 years, that's what we did. We invested in bigger machinery, in better infrastructure. We amalgamated dairies and bought sort of state-of-the-art dairies, brought them up into the 20th century, if not even the 21st. So we had milking parlors that looked like something out of NASA. We even divested and tried to increase our productivity in our crops by, of course, putting more and more chemicals on the land, more fertilizer, more herbicides, more fungicides, more pesticides. We tried to diversify into ice cream. We produced wonderful luxury ice cream until Haagen-Dazs, the Darth Vader of ice cream makers, came over into Europe and blew us out of the galaxy. We tried everything we could do to try and make this farm make a profit. And after 16 years, we were more in debt than ever. We were £1.5 million overdrawn at the bank, and we knew we couldn't go on. Our problem is that we are on marginal soils. We're on very, very heavy clay, 320 meters of it, over a bedrock of limestone, and it's just not cut out for intensive modern farming. So we finally made the decision to quit farming in 1999. It was a very unpopular decision, particularly with Charlie's family and neighbors who felt that we were going against the grain, literally, and they were very much in the mindset, as I think most of Europe and even North America is, of maximum production. Every available inch of land should be intensively farmed. But we realized the writing was on the wall for us. We just could not survive economically if we carried on. And we then happened to meet an amazing Dutch ecologist who has been really one of the forces for rewilding in Europe. And there are huge rewilding projects now in Europe. What he is saying is that if you want to recover biodiversity, and we by this stage felt very much that we wanted to do something with the land rather than battling against it all the time. So turning to a kind of nature conservation project seemed the obvious step for us. And Frans Vira, this Dutch ecologist, really showed us how that might happen. Obviously, if you just leave land, post-agricultural land, to its own devices, it's encountered a kind of catastrophic shift. It's become very degraded. It's not dynamic. It's very species poor. How do you kickstart that environment? How do you get something really functioning again? How do you get wildlife back into that landscape? And Frans Vira's answer is megafauna. It's large herbivores. And he believes that we have really ignored the part that megafauna would have played in our landscapes before human impact. And this is true for North America as it is for Europe. We've forgotten about the huge herds of bison, of horses, of cattle, of all these big animals that would have been present in huge numbers, in numbers that now seem natural to us pretty much only in Africa. And our landscapes would have been much more open, much more biodiverse, much more like a sort of kaleidoscope of open, shifting, moving landscapes. And that's what's rocket fuel for biodiversity. So we thought this was an experiment worth trying. If we could release some free-roaming herbivores onto our land, and critically, the key thing is to sit back and let these animals do the management for us. So that's a very difficult thing for human beings to do. But the ethos from the very start was to let these animals do what they would do naturally and then see what came of it. We had no expectations, no goals, no targets, other than hoping that we would recover biodiversity. So that's what we did.
And, you know, the thing that's so interesting is that in this story is that our understanding even of animals, you know, certainly of the kind, the herbivores that you're speaking of and other animals. And of course, herbivores mean that these animals tromp around and they eat vegetation. So that it's not just a kind of phantasmo-spiritual belief that animals, you know, can manage a landscape or play an important, you know, a critical role. It's actually, it's biological ecology, the interaction of these animals and a natural landscape that are made to go together. And so we have so extracted animals as we relate to them from their natural landscape that, you know, they're in our homes as pets. They're in factory farms being, you know, brutally treated. Or, you know, we ride them, you know, if they're horses or whatever. Or keep a, you know, fish bowl with little fish in it. You know, yeah. We don't really understand that they belong, because we haven't seen that they are inextricably belonging to nature, and that nature belongs to them in a way that isn't like fearful. Oh, some bug is going to bite me, or you know, if I go out in nature, or a snake may come along. You know, what you have created there is, it's almost, it's a return to a kind of Eden, you know, but it's actually the real, it's not a,
well,
a fan,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, I think, you know, you're absolutely right, and because we've been really observing these herbivores, the large megafauna, in artificial environments for so long, we forget that actually they are huge drivers of systems. The way they trample and rootle, the way they debark trees, the way they snap branches, the way they browse as well as graze, the way they move naturally migrating over big areas, and they can transport seeds and nutrients and minerals. They're hugely dynamic forces in the landscape, and we've just forgotten that. But I think one of the important things we need to note about rewilding, it's not really this idea of returning to an Eden of the past. We can never recover the past. We've changed our planet so much as human beings, we can't possibly hope to recover what it was like before us. What we can do, though, I think, is get inspiration from how landscapes were managed by these big animals in the past and how important they are, how they are keystone species, really, for kick-starting natural processes again. And we can use that knowledge to apply in the modern day with the tools that we have left at our disposal, that are available to us, to create novel ecosystems, as it were. So perhaps not even ecosystems that have been around before, but that are going to kickstart functioning processes again and be rocket fuel for wildlife. So obviously a lot of the megafauna have gone extinct, and that is hugely part, you know, our impact on them. We hunted most of these megafauna species to extinction. I think in the States, in the North America, I think you lost over 40 genera of megafauna after human impact. And in South America, it's more than 50. In Europe, we lost fewer because these species co-evolve with human beings. But still, we're missing these keystone species that co-evolve with the vegetation that still survives today. All our tree species and plant species co-evolved millions of years ago with these animals. But what we can do is we can use proxies of the disappeared, the ghosts of the megafauna of the past, if you like, and we can use domesticated descendants of them. So at NEP we have longhorn cattle, old English longhorn cattle, standing in for the aurochs, and we have Exmoor ponies standing in for tarpan. We have Tamworth pigs being wild boar. And what's astonishing is that when you release these domesticated animals into a natural environment, somewhere where they can forage, they can breed, they can sleep where they like, they eat where they like, they eat what they like, they can swim. We know that pigs can behave like hippos. We at NEP, they can even dive for swan mussels. They can hold their breath for 20 seconds. Suddenly you see these animals that, you know, perhaps in a farm setting look rather rather sort of boring and inconsequential, suddenly spring back to life, and you see the full kind of rainbow of what they of how they can express themselves in the landscape. And that's really, really exciting. Their instincts are still there, innate. They know how to self-medicate. Our cattle will eat sallow, which is a type of willow. It's what we get salicylic acid from, that we created aspirin from. And quite often, I can notice them eating the sallow, and I'm presuming that they're using that for aches and pains, or perhaps for ridding themselves of worm burden. But they also smear the sap. They break branches and smear the sap on their faces in the summer to get rid of insects, you know, sort of bothersome gnats and mosquitoes. So they have all this inside them, even though they've been domesticated for hundreds of years.
You know, I want to read one little, very short passage from the book, because, you know, it begins with the megafauna, but it goes on to encompass so many other species, and the book is such a pleasure because of your exquisite writing, as well as your observation, love, and knowledge, the knowledge of a naturalist about so many different natural species. So I'm just going to read this one little section, and we can kind of jump off from that. We're talking here about the blue jay, whom in the book you note was persecuted throughout the 19th century and continues to be, by some gamekeepers, seen as a robber of birds' nests, eating eggs and even chicks. But you call it an impressive all-rounder, also feeding on a variety of invertebrates, seeds, and fruits, and even occasionally small animals. You then point out that it has one particular specialty, its habit of burying acorns. So, you know, part of the connecting of the dots between the biodiverse species in our natural habitat is like this kind of understanding that, you know, one species is doing something that it naturally is prompted to do, but it can also have an impact on another entirely different species. And you go on to talk about oaks and why the blue jay, you know, ostensibly a bad guy, is actually participating in a larger system through its habit of burying acorns. Can you just talk about that a little bit for us?
Yes, I mean, this is something that we've completely forgotten in our modern landscape. A jay can bury 6,000 acorns in 4 weeks, just one single jay. And when you see a jay flying around the garden or the locality with one acorn in its beak, it's actually got five other acorns stuffed back down its gullet. It's carrying probably five or six acorns at one time. And this bird has co-evolved with the oak tree because it plays a vital role in reestablishing oak in the wider landscape. Oak trees in Europe, and certain species of your oak tree over here too, cannot regenerate in shady conditions. It needs light. It needs light, open spaces. So the jay, if that acorn fell from the tree directly underneath the canopy, it's not going to survive. It's not going to produce another oak. It's very unlike beech in this respect, say, something like that. But what it needs is a vector. It needs something to carry that acorn away from the host plant and plant it somewhere where it's going to be able to survive in sunlight. And what the jay does is it looks for a sort of upright, a vertical that it can remember where it's planted the seed. And that could be, you know, a straggly piece of hawthorn or blackthorn or bramble, something out in the open landscape. And it buries the acorn or a stash of acorns at the bottom of that little thorny scrub. And this thorny scrub then provides natural barbed wire for that sapling as it grows. It is protection from browsing by deer and rabbits. And this is nature's way of how trees are regenerated. Thorny scrub is hugely, hugely important in the regeneration of trees, as are the birds and the wind that disperse the seeds. So we don't, you know, we there's a big drive at the moment, and it's laudable, to get more trees in our landscape to recover our woodlands. and hugely important for sequestering carbon. But I think the question is, how do we do that? And if we're going out there with a spade, digging a hole, putting a tunnelized wooden stake, a polypropylene cylindrical tube, tying it with plastic, importing whips from nurseries, saplings from nurseries, which may have been grown artificially, which may be importing disease, that's a very costly, very labor-intensive, high-carbon way of getting trees back in the landscape. They will get there, but the success rate will be very low. The immunity of those trees from other diseases will also be low because they haven't been connected with all the mycorrhizal, the fungal connections underground that they need from the very, very moment that they are germinated. So you're producing trees that are, in a sense, artificial. You're producing a plantation. And it's certainly something that is not going to be ultimately very biodiverse. It's not going to be dynamic. It's not going to be wonderful for wildlife. So, you know, we are at the moment in Britain planning a huge northern forest that's going to be planted, and it's going to cost the taxpayer £500 million. Well, that's, you know, a huge expense, and we're going to be planting an artificial plantation. How much more exciting if we left it to the jay, left it to that bird and all the other birds and the wind that can carry seeds in, allow those new trees to come up in thorny scrub, and then release free-roaming animals to engage with that thorny scrub and create something much, much more dynamic. It would be a natural way of doing it, very low carbon, very low cost, and a much more interesting and biodiverse habitat at the end of it.
Yes, and in this country, I don't know if this is true in Europe. I hope it isn't, but for example, there was an announcement that, you know, in California, the city of L.A. is planting trees, and, you know, people who now have, you know, a growing awareness of climate are, you know, oh, good, we're planting trees. But the trees that they're planting are, you know, grown with a, you know, from seeds that have a pesticide, as part of the actual tree. They're therefore exuding pesticides and herbicides that kill off pollinators, you know. So even when we think or hope or have the good intention to do something that, you know, is simple and sounds like it just should be the easiest thing in the world and it should be beneficial, let's plant a tree. In fact, when it's in the hands of the industrialist mindset, even if it's apparently, you know, could or should have been healthy, they're doing it in a way that profits those industries and that therefore is disseminating these poisonous chemicals that harm other life. And so, you know, we need to really have the kinds of example that you're providing so that we're really understanding, you know, not just reacting to a slogan, let's plant more trees.
Yes, you know. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And of course, it's a wonderful way of engaging people, and, you know, particularly engaging younger generations with the idea of planting a tree. That physical contact of actually planting a tree and watching it grow is hugely powerful. And I think that could and perhaps should be part of how we engage children, particularly in nature. But as you say, we have to be very careful of how we do it. And I think what our rewilding project at NEP has shown us is that it really pays to take a much more a sort of humble approach, I think, to nature, and to just observe how she does it. Nature has had millions of years of R&D. Nature knows how to protect trees from pests. You know, nature has all these existing herbicides and pesticides and biological controls that are already out there and work hugely effectively without being destructive. And so if we can work with nature rather than battling against it all the time, I think that is the lesson. it's the same, I think, that we've been noticing in our sort of wanderings around America recently. We've been here for a month, talking to people who are into regenerative farming and how just farming along the principles of nature without any chemical inputs can actually produce more food on your land, but with no carbon cost. It actually is helping pull down carbon into the soils, and that's what rewilding does too. So I think both rewilding and regenerative agriculture are going to be the way forward, and it's hugely hopeful, I think. It is the way that the world is going to progress. We just hope that it's going to be sooner rather than later.
When you tour around and talk with either landholders or farmers and share your experience, are you hearing an openness, or, you know, what would you say are the kinds of sticking points that we need to help people get through in order to really look at this new paradigm of opportunity, but one which involves some social change from what we've traditionally believed in, known, and acted upon?
Well, I think in the last couple of years, I think I've been more hopeful than ever before. I think something has happened. I don't know whether it's Extinction Rebellion, the climate change revolution, plastics revolution. Something is happening. There's a tipping point, it feels, out there. And I think public perceptions are changing. And I'm coming across people all the time who are changing their minds and looking at how we can change things with a much more open, creative, inventive mindset. And certainly this feeling that the future relies on public opinion, public change, rather than just leaving it to politicians and to sort of big industry. And that's so exciting. But I think one of the big obstacles to thinking our way out of this fix is really it's one of aesthetics. I think we've grown up with landscapes that are very managed, very controlled, that somehow makes us feel secure somehow, that we're doing something, that we are managing nature. And if we are to release, as E.O. Wilson, the great American biologist, encourages us to think, we need to release half Earth back to nature if we're going to recover biodiversity and also recover the systems on which human life, that our species, depends. And that means we have to really think much more openly about our landscapes and to get messy. We've got to stop this sort of Victorian obsession we have with tidying up all the time. We have to release natural processes so that we can allow these boom and bust cycles of nature to function and not panic when we see, you know, suddenly a pioneer species taking over the land. And to understand that actually in the longer term, this is just the beginning of something different happening. Pioneer species are very conspicuous, but they're needed in order to make way for the subsequent species that develop on land. And so it's really, I think, about letting go in our minds and just being much more open about what we're prepared to have out in our landscapes. I think Charlie and I have noticed while we've been traveling around America that there's a lot of people ask about invasive species. It seems to be a real thing over here. I think in Europe, because, you know, we had centuries and centuries and centuries of millennia of invasive species, we've almost completely lost the plot. We can't even remember what's native and what isn't. And so in America, though, I think there's still very much a conscious fear of invasive species. And I think that's one of the things we need to be much more pragmatic about. I think America, in one decade, spent $56 billion on trying to control invasive species, and with no success, or little success, certainly didn't manage to eradicate any. So I think we have to be pragmatic and and understand that some species are going to be here to stay. Some that we think are the real bogeymen of the landscape may not be so harmful as we first think. They're conspicuous when they first arrive, but sooner or later things settle down, and there may actually be advantages to having them here. In Europe, we have a recent colonizer, is Himalayan balsam. It's a very pretty pink flower that travels through watercourses. And the newspapers were full of headlines of Day of the Triffids, you know, our waterways were going to be completely clogged with this plant, we were never going to see any of our native water plants ever again. And what we've seen in the last decade is that actually Himalayan balsam has retracted quite a lot. Maybe there's already some pathogens working on it, or something that's actually beginning to reduce it in scale. But some very interesting biological reports are showing that it's a late flowerer in our waterways, and actually that's been hugely positive for pollinating insects. So, you know, I think we are quite often dominated by the sort of fear factor when it comes to invasive species, and perhaps, dare I say it, it's even driven by the Monsantos and the herbicide makers of this world.
That makes complete sense. And also, you know, I've been tracking that for a while, because I began many years ago also reporting on proactive medicine. In other words, ways to eat healthy food and to do gentler kinds of therapies to protect health and build balance and immunity, so that you don't get to the point where a weakened body is fighting off pathogens, and you know, you have to take all of these heavy drugs and antibiotics, which we now know undermine the human microbiome, as well as having effects in the ecology when we, you know, kind of excrete them into the waterways and everything like that. And so I think we've been taught, you know, to regard, you know, single out and regard one part of a natural cycle as an enemy, and you know, and try to eradicate it. And it's very deep into the mindset. And I think, unfortunately, we see the parallel. It's all too obvious, of, you know, regarding peoples who have come from foreign lands seeking refuge or better opportunity, and who, you know, have long been constructive participants in our diverse, you know, society, which we've always had here in the States, you know, being singled out and created as other, and made the, you know, made to be the source of whatever problems that we have. And so it's interesting to me, given, you know, our tendency to do that, and the way we have sadly gone down that road with so many of these for-profit industries, and of course, you know, the treatment of agriculture and the fear of bugs and all of that that you describe is the same as in medicine. It's kind of part and parcel of the same thing, and is leading us to really see friends and allies in all different levels as enemies and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes, I think it is very, very interesting, and we also, you know, forget that. You know, that as I was saying, is nature, you know, the more biodiverse a system that we have, the harder it is for invasives, if that's what we want to call them, to get in. So we have a problem in Europe with American mink. They were released from fur farms in the 1970s, and they have been decimating wildlife. There has been, you know, a considerable problem, and thanks to the mink, we have lost huge numbers of our native water voles and all sorts of other species. But what we're seeing now is that we had got rid of almost all our otters in Europe, largely for fur, and also because they were not tolerated by fishermen. But now that the otter is on the rise, the otter is actually getting rid of American mink, because they predate on the American mink kits. So the American mink isn't used to the Eurasian otter as a predator, and finds it very difficult to fight back. So wherever you have otters now in our waterways, we now don't have American mink. The same with the American gray squirrel. That's been in Britain for centuries. I think it was introduced in the mid-19th century, or maybe earlier, actually. And it it has pushed out our native red squirrel. And it also has a very destructive, is very destructive for young trees. But now, you know, it was able to march in to that open door, in a way, because we had got rid of the pine marten, which is its natural predator. Now the pine marten is coming back, and it's now being introduced into areas like the Forest of Dean. We're seeing gray squirrel numbers completely disappear. So, you know, it's very interesting how the whole thing works. And the more complete an ecosystem is, I think the harder it is for species to come in. We had another example. We had ring-neck parakeets, which are now living in most of the parks around London. They're a species that's an exotic species. I think they come from Australia originally. I'm not entirely sure. But we saw these parakeets, you know, very noisy, squawking flock of parakeets flying over Nep a couple of years ago. And we thought, okay, well, this is a new addition to the rewilding site. But because we now have so many birds up in the sky, we have so many predators, and we have red-tailed kites, we have peregrine falcons, we have buzzards, we have five different species of owl, we have ravens. It's full the sky up there, and the ringneck parakeets just disappeared after a couple of days. They just couldn't find a way in.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about the species also that have come back to NEP, your property, since you've been wilding again, because it's not just the mega herbivores and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's the knock-on effect that really has been so astonishing. So the only thing we've introduced into the site, onto the 3,500 acres, are the free-roaming animals. Everything else has found us because the habitat has now come back and there's now a food source for them. So we now have some of the rarest species in Britain. We have ravens back for the first time in 100 years. We have cuckoos, which have they've declined over 90% since the 1970s. We're now one of the biggest breeding hotspots for nightingales. Again, another hugely declining species. That's all, you know, the famous Ode to a Nightingale, Keats's Ode to a Nightingale. You know, we're about to lose nightingales from Britain altogether. And perhaps the most poignant for me, I think, is the turtle dove. It's when I was growing up in the 1960s, we had 125,000 pairs of turtle doves in Britain. You know, this is what Chaucer and Shakespeare write about, and it's what we sing about at Christmas with our carols. What my true love gave to me was two turtle doves. But now their numbers are so low, they've declined over 97% since the 1970s, and we are about to lose them in the next 10 to 15 years from our islands, from Britain. Which to me is a huge sadness. That's the song of summer. That's the sound, that lovely, beautiful purring sound they make, is going to be gone forever. But at NEP, NEP is now the only place in the UK where turtle dove numbers are actually rising, where they are breeding and increasing every year. And that's because we've got the habitat, we've got the food sources for them, we've got these native wildflowers, which again we have zero tolerance for in our gardens and our roadside verges and our arable landscapes. We've got these native wildflowers which produce the protein-rich seeds that turtle doves depend on. And we also have clean water for them. Turtle doves are very fussy, like most doves. They produce a milk which they feed to their young. And they need clean water to produce that milk. But most standing water in our landscapes today are either polluted by nitrates or by runoff from roads or towns and villages. So it's very difficult even to find clean water in our landscape. But now we have all those resources at NEP, and birds like turtle doves are rocketing. So in less than 20 years, we've gone from a landscape that was one of the most biologically depleted landscapes in Britain to one of the most important areas for nature in Britain in less than 20 years. It's astonished us, but it's astonished the scientists as well. No one can quite believe it. It's amazing.
You know, it's interesting because you told this story at your talk, and of course you talk about this in the book as well. But it's also that you know, as you talk about the turtle dove and how it's been, you know, mentioned in literature and how it's kind of synonymous with the joy and burgeoning and growth in the summer season. In certain climates, you know, it really brings up the notion that our own qualities and our own connection to nature and ability to feel and to navigate are nurtured by these other creatures. And if the turtle doves, you know, which are kind of the loving pair, don't have fresh water, you know, we may think, oh, well, you know, the water can be purified, or if I'm in a privileged community, I'll always have good water. But, you know, we don't think about that certain wildlife that that carries certain traits that resonate to other beings and nurture other beings in their own qualities and being are also reliant upon the natural sources and goods that are intrinsic to Earth that we have been despoiling and playing around with. So, you know, I even wonder if this tremendous depletion and happily the return of these creatures and the resonances and potential they carry is also informing and transformational toward humans and toward people in regaining and valuing our best qualities rather than creating such a big space for our worst qualities.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think certainly charismatic species like the turtle dove that we have a sort of, you know, a big connection to, that we feel some sort of empathy with, that resonate with us somehow, have a big role in, you know, as being a sort of flagship, really, for what's happening out there in the wider landscape. And they can be hugely useful, I think, as markers of what's happening. But also, when we're at risk of losing them, it makes us sit up and think. But I think also, in just more general terms, I think our connection with nature and what we've lost really speaks volumes. And we're beginning to see, the more urban we become, the more we risk from disconnecting ourselves from nature, that we need wild places, not just for our physical well-being, for cleaning our air and for breathing gulpfuls of it when we go running or cycling or walking in wild places, but also psychologically we need these wild places, and it's partly our divorce from nature in its wildest form that I think has led us down this path that we've been going on, you know, for this and the last century. E.O. Wilson has a wonderful word for it, biophilia. You know, it's that innate desire in all of us to connect with living things. And I think that's what people feel when they come to NEP, is that suddenly they're standing not just in a green space, because green spaces can be deserts too. Parks are often deserts. But this is humming, thrumming, buzzing, heaving with life. It's the surround sound birdsong and the sound of insects that we so often don't even notice we're missing. And when you're standing in that atmosphere, you feel like you're suddenly plugged back in to where you belong. There's a sense of kind of completeness. You can relax and let go. You can actually feel your that things are right with the world again. And I think the more we can provide places like NEP, the more we can demonstrate that rewilding can provide all these sort of crucial things that we need, like carbon sequestration and all the other, you know, provisions, the public goods that we need, but also that it has this effect on us psychologically, that once you've visited a place that is really full of life and it's just on your doorstep, then when you go to other places where there's no birdsong or no insects, you know then what you're missing.
you know that something isn't quite right. And the more, I think, we'll become demanding that we have this back.
And also, I mean, that is just beautiful, and I think it's really true, and I wish that more people, you know, had access, you know, and even, you know, through reading this book and seeing, you know, hopefully a film that will be made about it one day, I think can provide that. And, you know, it would also be great if other people who are landholders are, you know, inspired to do this. I also want to inquire, because those smaller regenerative farming, you know, it doesn't require 3,000 plus acres, you know, but it's a smaller way that, you know, is possible, and there's a movement, you know, to do that in the States here and elsewhere internationally. You know, those pockets created by farms also, you know, are part of that greater chain. And, you know, I just want to also make sure that people listening to the show understand that, and, you know, this may be our final question before we come to the end of our program, but, you know, that people understand that this is also, that the intention is not to produce a business, but an after effect of this is that, in fact, this is viable. Rather than, you know, a pipe dream off in isolation somewhere, from, you know, the natural economies of our world through which people do things. So could you share a little bit about the productivity side of NEP?
Absolutely. I mean, it has to work economically. You know, we can't do this altruistically. We would never be able to sustain that. It has to work economically. And for us, it does now. We have an ecotourism business that's based on a kind of African model with safaris and glamping and camping. So we have thousands of people who want to come and see British wildlife. There's a huge resurgence of interest in our own species, which is wonderful. And so they come to get this experience of camping out in a wild patch of land just south of London. We also produce meat from the project, so we keep our animal numbers low so that you have this interaction with the vegetation, so you're creating habitat. Obviously, we know the dangers of overgrazing. We see that in our agricultural lands everywhere. But if you have this interaction, this natural balance between the vegetation and the animals, then you get, you know, this astonishing rocket fuel for biodiversity. So we cull our animals and we sell the meat, and that is also a productive income for us. And we also now have converted our agricultural buildings, which, as any farmer will know, is a huge drain on expenses and doesn't bring in any income. But once you're not farming, you can convert these buildings into office space, light industrial use, storage space. And there's so many people out there who don't want to sit in a traffic jam to get to work, but would much rather be sitting in a lovely office looking onto an environment where you can see pigs diving for swan mussels. So there are new income streams that are kind of unleashed when you let go of farming, I think. But I think one thing I feel is worth emphasizing is that, you know, we are a comparatively large piece of land, but it really also applies to smallholders and even to gardens. We can all do our bit to get nature back. The important thing, I think, is connectivity. We can't have isolated wildernesses or national parks, even if they're huge. We need to get nature right back close to us again, and we need to have really functioning ecosystems around our cities to clean our air, to clean our water, and for human enjoyment. So everybody has a part to play, I think, anyone who owns a garden, a window box. But even if you have a few acres out in the wider landscape, you can become part of a wildlife corridor that connects areas of biodiversity hotspots and nature reserves together. You can even become part of a stepping stone so that the little pockets of land that link up together that can enable populations of species to move through the landscape again. And that will make those species much more viable, much more resilient in the future in the face of climate change and pollution and everything else.
Well, yeah, that's incredible. What is your next project? I mean, this is plenty, obviously, but is there any new turn or new plan or new engagement?
Yes, I mean, you know, we're not sitting still. We have, I mean, the wonderful thing about a rewilding project is you don't have any aims for it, really, except to let it do its own thing. But we hope that we already have been talking to landowners around us. We have two landowners who've added 600 acres and another has added 300 acres to the project. So they've pulled up their boundaries and have included themselves in our rewilding area, which is very exciting. We're just starting talking to farmers in the neighborhood. So 30 farmers have joined a farm cluster with NEP as the lead project. So we hope that we will be able to spread that kind of wildlife-friendly practices through all the neighboring farms around us so that eventually we'll be able to have wildlife back along our river catchment all the way down to the sea. So that's very exciting. That's a proposal that's in front of the government at the moment, and we hope we'll get the green light for that. And we've just applied for our license to reintroduce beavers, so to release beavers on NEP. And we're crossing our fingers that we will get them because they're a keystone species, and, of course, they're amazing hydrological engineers, and they will create yet more habitat at NEP for wildlife.
Wow, that's incredible. How are they hydrological engineers? Like, what do they do?
Oh, I mean, America's done so much research into this. I mean, you know, in North America, beavers have rebounded, and they're back in the millions. And they, the way they create dams, the way they allow nitrates and pollutants to filter through that system, they actually clean water, they store water, and they release it very safely in times of floods through their damming systems, so they can prevent floods from happening, so we don't need to spend such huge amounts of money on hard revetments to stop floods happening. And, of course, we're going to be seeing more floods in the future with climate change. Beavers are a huge impact on biodiversity as well, on fish and all the invertebrates in water systems. But it's really their control, how they manage water, that is just so ingenious and that we can still learn a lot from.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, it's been a complete delight to talk with you and hear all about this. Isabella Tree, and listeners, look for Isabella's book, Wilding, Returning Nature to Our Farm. And if you are in the UK or planning to visit, look to go to and visit NEP in West Sussex. I know if I get that way, I certainly will. And it's been lovely talking with you, Isabella Tree, and also knowing that you and your vision and wisdom are here in the U.S. For this period of time. And, you know, thank you for visiting, and, you know, safe travels to your return to England. And, you know, thank you so much for joining me on Connect the Dots today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. If you've enjoyed this program, it will be in archives later today at connectthedots.podbean.com. And you can share that on social media so that other people can learn more about wilding and read Isabella's book. And thank you for being with us. We'll be back for another edition of Connect the Dots next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well, stand tall, and keep walking forward. And I just want to parenthetically comment that the theme music for the show, which opens and closes it, is Bobby McFerrin.